This is the Counseling Convos podcast. I'm Jarius Shaheen. It's 1798, and the mental health world is about to get a refreshing new take on what otherwise was known as demonic possession. Philippe Pinel, born April 20th, 1745, was a French physician who pioneered the human treatment of the mentally ill. He was born in 1745, a tender-hearted and shy young man. Pinel was considered an ideal candidate for the priesthood. In 1765, at age 22, he moved to the city of Toulouse to study theology. In Toulouse, he came under the influence of enlightened thinkers, such as Voltaire, who took a dim view of traditional religion. In 1770, Pinel decided to follow in his father's footsteps rather than studying for the priesthood. He began studying medicine, receiving a doctorate in 1773 at age 28. He then moved to the university town of Montpellier for 4 years, completing his practical education in hospitals by the age of 32. So he moved to Paris in 1778 at age 33 and was refused permission to practice medicine in France's capital because his medical degree was from Toulouse, a provincial university. He made a modest living in Paris, working as a medical writer, translator, mathematics tutor. But things looked up in 1784 when he was appointed editor of Gazette de Santé, a health journal. A friend's suicide prompted him to investigate mental illness. He began writing about mental illness, and he also secured employment in a private asylum where he would study severe mental illness more thoroughly. This is Act One. In 1785, at age 40, he joined the Saloon, a club where intellectuals met and exchanged philosophical ideas. The same year, he met Franz Mesmer, who left Paris under a cloud. Mesmer had made a fortune using animal magnetism to treat people with psychosomatic diseases. Pinel noted that Mesmer's methods seemed to work for some people, but not for others. Then the French Revolution began in 1789. Pinel was moderately sympathetic to its aims, and he was friendly with other sympathizers at the Saloon, but he was focused on the mentally ill. See, in the 1700s, it was normal practice to restrain mentally ill people by chaining them to the walls of hospitals or asylums. Having worked in an asylum, Pinel was interested to see how mentally ill patients were treated. So through his work and movement, he did away with such treatments as bleeding, purging, and blistering. He favored a therapy that included close and friendly interactions and contact with patients, discussion of personal difficulties, a program that had purposeful activities. He promoted the idea that mentally ill people should be understood as individuals. He He recommended that physicians should keep case notes on their patients, firstly to understand their illnesses, then to evaluate the effectiveness of treatments more reliably. Up until this point, patients of various symptomologies were chained up, mistreated, even laughed at. Fast forward to modern day. I'm going to provide some excerpts from a few books. The first one is The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. My aim is to provide elements of modern day reflections to see if we are equally blind to the impacts of mental health and trauma today, as maybe the public was back in Peniel's time. First quote. For years, mental health professionals taught people that they could be psychologically healthy without social support. That unless you love yourself, no one will love you. The truth is, you cannot love yourself unless you have been loved and are loved. The capacity to love cannot be built in isolation. Quote 2. To develop a self, one must exercise choice and learn from the consequences of those choices. If the only thing you are taught is to comply, you have little way of knowing what you like and want. Quote 3, and this is a lengthy one, so bear with me. The responses of traumatized children are often misrepresented. Because new situations are inherently stressful, and because youth who have been through trauma often come from homes in which chaos and unpredictability appear normal to them. They may respond with fear to what is actually a calm and safe situation. Attempting to take control of what they believe is the inevitable return of chaos, they appear to provoke it in order to make things feel more comfortable and predictable. Thus, the honeymoon period in foster care will end as the child behaves defiantly and destructively in order to prompt familiar screaming and harsh discipline. Like everyone else, they feel more comfortable with what is familiar. As one family therapist famously put it, we tend to prefer the certainty of misery to the misery of uncertainty. I'd like to reference The Body Keeps the Score. Quote 1. Traumatized people chronically feel unsafe inside their bodies. The past is alive in the form of gnawing interior discomfort. Their bodies are constantly bombarded by visceral warning signs, and in an attempt to control these processes, they often become experts at ignoring their gut feelings and in numbing awareness of what is played out inside. They learn to hide from themselves. Quote 2. Being able to feel safe with other people is probably the single most important aspect of mental health. Safe connections are fundamental to meaningful and satisfying lives. Quote 3. Beneath the surface of the protective parts of trauma survivors, there exists an undamaged essence, a self that is confident, curious, and calm, a self that has been sheltered from destruction by the various protectors that have merged their efforts to endure and ensure survival. Once those protectors trust that it is safe to separate, the self will spontaneously emerge, and the parts can be enlisted in the healing process. Quote 4. As the ACE study has shown, child abuse and neglect is the single most preventable cause of mental illness, the single most common cause of drug and alcohol abuse, and a significant contributor to leading causes of death, such as diabetes, heart disease, cancer, stroke, and suicide.
I have seen trauma impact people's lives in many ways. My specific area of focus has been on victims/survivors of Munchausen's by proxy, otherwise known as factitious disorder imposed on another. I am shocked that this disorder can affect people in so many unique ways, and yet there is no term for those that have survived this abuse.
Jordan Hope is a recovery coach in St. Louis, Missouri. Jordan mainly works with people struggling with eating disorders, but is passionate about providing education and care to individuals with a history of trauma and abuse.
People that survive this abuse are often very disconnected from their bodies. They may suffer from PTSD, eating disorders, Munchausen's, somatization disorders, etc. They often have a negative self-image and are unaware of their actual health status. They tend to be overly concerned by minor ailments while simultaneously avoiding doctors and medications for fear of being harmed. It can be incredibly hard for survivors to find help within the medical world as well as the mental health world because of the lack of research that has been done on this type of abuse, and especially the lack of research on the victim/survivor.
That's where Jordan comes in. She had been working as a recovery coach for those struggling with mental illness and has more recently stepped back from that role to put her focus on MBP victims and survivors. She has spent her time doing research online, reading books on the subject, talking with survivors, and speaking with other experts in the field.
There's a website that was created in 2021 by Dr. Mark Feldman, Michael Weber, Andrea Dunlop, and others. Sadly, that is really the only information out there that discusses how to help those that have survived this abuse. While this website offers a lot of support and insight, we need to find more ways to actually help the survivor heal.
While Missouri and other states have resources and training tracks to become trauma-informed and specific modalities of trauma therapies, many clinical centers find ongoing training to be difficult to attain and manage for their staff and clinicians. Often, therapists and the like are on their own in attaining certifications and training related to trauma. One great resource is Resiliency Builders, ran by Marsha Morgan, as well as the work and collaboration of the Missouri Coalition for Community Behavioral Healthcare. As it stands, many seasoned therapists hold random series training, conferences, and the like regarding trauma-informed care. State to state, it varies as well. SAMHSA has a PDF resource titled Concept of Trauma and Guidance for a Trauma-Informed Approach. The Institute on Trauma out of the University of Buffalo School of Social Work has a great guide on how to mobilize your agency to be trauma-informed. There are many resources out there, but it can be difficult to land in the right place.
I have learned a lot about trauma-informed care. St. Louis seems to be lacking on options in this area. Honestly, most states are lacking on options, especially in regards to treatment centers or higher level options like intensive outpatient, partial hospitalization programs, and residential centers. I find this to be such a disservice because people with trauma need more holistic, body-focused therapies. We have a long way to go in the mental health field to get to a place of being able to fully help people.
Jordan, in what ways have you found yourself advocating for trauma-informed care and mental illness?
I have spoken mostly at colleges about different types of mental illnesses and effects of trauma. In 2019, I had the opportunity to travel to LA and speak on the show The Doctors about my personal experience with Munchausen's by proxy and the effects it has had on my life. I was able to get my pediatrician to join the show and speak about things from the side of the medical field. I was able to raise awareness to this abuse in a realistic way versus all of the dramatized examples that I've seen on TV. Many segments from my show can be seen on YouTube.
Jordan is a true pioneer in the industry. Her, as well as many other similar clinicians sprinkled throughout our nation. It takes many voices and much energy to build new paths to treatment, and especially to make them normalized. This industry is ever-changing because we are ever-changing. It's encouraging to hear from Jordan, but more so creates opportunity for like-minded clinicians to band together and collectively work towards united fronts in healthcare. Perhaps even one day we can provide therapy across state lines as one unified front. Peniel started making further changes to the management of mentally ill patients. He abandoned ancient treatments such as Galen's bloodletting, which he could find no clinical evidence in favor of. He recognized that he was dealing with individual people with specific problems rather than a uniform mass of lunatics. He abolished visits by ghoulish members of the public who paid to come to laugh, ridicule, upset, and sneer at patients. This was viewed as normal. He visited his patients daily, talking to them one-on-one, observing their behaviors, building up case files on each person. Not in the sense of case files as they are today. Files and documents where he can fully and deeply understand the person he's working with. Not simply to document for reflective purposes or for billing purposes. He gathered much evidence from a large number of cases in order to rationalize mental illness, to understand its causes, and to devise effective therapies. He believed that patients should be treated in clean, pleasant, stimulating environments. Doctors should engage with patients in gaining their trust. They should find out about their lives. The relationship between doctor and patient, or therapist and client, or clinician and client, should be similar to one of trust. It should be trusted by the patient and should act with firmness if necessary in regards to direct reflection. Do you think we're there? Do you trust your doctors, your counselors, your therapists, your caregivers? Do you trust healthcare? When we connect with a professional, we have to believe that there is an element of care involved, a human element that allows us to be fully us and be believed or cared for it. I'd like to give you another quote. The essence of trauma is that it is overwhelming, unbelievable, and unbearable. Each patient demands, each client demands that we suspend our sense of what is normal and accept that we are dealing with a dual reality. The reality of a relatively secure and predictable present that lives side by side with a ruinous ever-present past. I recently presented a live training on emotional precision. The training was meant to evoke the powerful nature of truly knowing what our emotions are telling us and how to define them better. The audience consisted of therapists, behavioral techs, peer specialists, basically mental health care workers. In presenting this information, I knew I had to be cognizant of people's backgrounds, traumas, and the like. I also know those that needed to would share their thoughts. Through this training, a voice spoke up and shared energetically the importance of understanding emotion. That voice was Madison's.
Hello, hello. My name is Madison Harrell. I am a grateful member of recovery. Because of recovery, I'm a present mother, a present wife, a present daughter, a present friend, a present employee, and most importantly to me, a present follower of Jesus Christ. I believe without my higher power, the life I live today wouldn't be possible. I'm in recovery from substance use, depression, and anxiety. And ultimately, I'm in recovery from trauma because I believe that my trauma has directly caused some of the issues that I experienced today, which I'll get into a little bit later. Because of everything that I've been through and been in recovery from, I was recently told about a position called a CPS, or a Certified Peer Specialist. After looking into it, I just was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I was put on this earth for. And I recently became a Certified Peer Specialist through the state of Missouri. And what a peer specialist does is we worked directly with people who are experiencing mental health or substance use, and we use our own experience to benefit those who are currently struggling. And never in a million years would I have ever believed, you know, 5 years ago, which I'll have 5 years sober shortly, or in recovery, I never would have believed that I would be helping other people, because I couldn't even help myself. You know, I didn't even love myself back then. And today I can confidently say that, you know, I do love myself today. And it wasn't something I could do on my own. It was something that I had to be shown by others in my support groups. One of the most profound things that I was told early on when I entered into a 12-step program, somebody said, "We know you don't love yourself right now, but we will love you until you can learn to love yourself again." And that gave me the hope that I needed, that spark of hope I needed to start my journey in recovery.
Madison is planning to work her way into a counselor level position. She revels in the comparison of who she is today versus who she was in her past. Madison is motivated and propelled by her journey and carries a confidence in her tone.
I am extremely blessed to have the family that I have. You know, I know not everyone is fortunate enough to grow up the way I did, but, you know, my parents were very loving and supportive, my siblings as well. I mean, you know, early on we fought and, you know, it was hell sometimes, but at the end of the day, today, you know, my family is always there for me, and I've had positive influence from them, both in my previous life and also now in recovery. And they support me and they love me. And even though I, you know, when I was going through the thick of my addiction and depression and anxiety, you know, I treated them like crap. I treated a lot of people like crap. And I'm just so grateful that they have been able to forgive me and love me regardless of the things that I've done. Some other positive role models that have, you know, influenced and shown me that I can change my life, I would say originally was my ex-boyfriend. He was the only reason, I believe, that I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for the first time. I was in a place in my life where I had my son taken away out of my custody. He was put into state custody. It was definitely the most traumatic event that has ever happened to me in my life. And, you know, looking back, it didn't happen to me. I caused it. I was responsible. And today I look back and, you know, at first it was the most traumatic. It was the worst thing that had ever done, that had ever happened. And today, it's one of the best things looking back, because without that experience, I wouldn't have been propelled into recovery and have the life that I have today without that. So I am forever grateful for the police and the neighbors that showed up and stepped in when I was unable to care for my son. So after walking into my first AA meeting, I was met with this whole new world that I had no idea existed. You know, people in recovery, you know, never would I think today, all of the people in my life, my friends, my husband, pretty much my whole support come from the community of recovery. I no longer have relations with anyone from the life I lived previous to recovery. It doesn't mean that I don't care about those people anymore. I love them and I think of them often. They are living a life that is not helpful for my life in recovery today. And, you know, I'll always be there for those people should they ever enter into the rooms, as we say it in recovery. But, you know, I had to change through suggestions of others in program. I had to change the people, the places, and the things in my life. Everything had to be changed for me to not only recover, but to maintain my recovery. Some other people who have modeled positive change in my life, I would attribute to some of the therapists that have been with me through my walk, counselors. I had received inpatient treatment. I've also done intensive outpatient treatment. So, you know, all of the staff, including, you know, the behavioral health technicians, the counselors, the nutritionists, the you know, everybody helped me in a positive way, showed me new ways to live my life, you know, that I wasn't captive to the life that I lived before, that there was a different way to live life. You know, I thought getting into sobriety and living this quote unquote normal life would be boring. And, you know, it is not the case. I have the most amazing life today. I have some of the most fun and continue to have fun more so than I ever did in my previous life. You know, it's amazing the mental shift that I have experienced through the positive role models that have come in and out of my life and continue to come in and out of my life. You know, I work in a healthcare setting today, and my coworkers model that for me, and I'm able to model that for them. And it's so amazing how full circle recovery is when you come in and you get from everybody. You're just sucking everything you can from other people to recover. And then you get on the other side of it and you're able to give it all back. And it's not this like, oh, I have to help somebody or, oh, I have to do this. It's like, no, I want to do this. Like, it has instilled this desire and this drive in me. I want other people to have what I have today. Sometimes, you know, the girls I work with in the residential treatment center that I'm at, I wish, you know, some of them leave unsuccessfully. They leave early. And gosh, I wish it was possible just to give them a glimpse, just a taste of the life that I live today, the life that I have today, because I stayed, you know, because I held on in those hard times that I wanted to quit and I wanted to go back. I'm so grateful, whatever that power was. I believe, again, Jesus was the power that kept me in it. And I'm grateful for that. But man, if I could just bottle it up and be able to give them a taste, so that would give them, you know, that hope. I mean, I guess I give them hope. I know I give them hope today by modeling it for them. But man, if I could just bottle it up and give it to people and they could just see, you know, we don't know until we know, but it takes work. You know, recovery is not, I would say it's the easiest or it's the most simple path, but it's not the easiest. If it was, everybody would do it. But gosh, I'm just so grateful today for my experiences that led me into this new life.
Madison's story is one that showcases the strength and power behind advocacy and compassion. Those who survive are left with a lot to give. Madison is a type of soul that will never turn down a chance to serve. Often, we look at the lens of trauma through victimization and dread, My hope was to give a sense of empowerment to those who survive, a showcasing that the journey, the story, the resources, the industry of mental health is a well to draw from, and it can be an empowering experience. So to those who survive, you're not alone. You have come from a lot and will have a lot to give, a lot of insight, a lot of comfort, a lot of reflection leading to self-discovery.